This is the When You Die podcast. If it has to do with death and dying, we're talking about it. Today's host is Kelly McLean.
My guest today is Charlie Rosicky. Charlie is a licensed clinical social worker. He's worked as a hospice social worker for 14 years and more recently for the past 3 years as a grief counselor in Lafayette, Colorado. Charlie is also a meditation teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. Along with his wonderful wife, Nora Marie, Charlie founded and directed the mindfulness-based Shotoku Children's Center. There, he taught meditation and contemplative arts to many children, including, drumroll, myself. It was really a pleasure to, all these years later, get to sit down with Charlie and talk about grief, something that I have been struggling with the last couple of years since the sudden passing of my brother, and something that Charlie spends his days thinking about and soaking in as he supports people going through it. So we talked about what grief does to the body and mind and family, and something called complicated grief and how to work with it.
I was talking to a guy that last week, I think, who was grieving the loss, the death of his wife, and he was asleep in his living room, and someone put their hand on his shoulder, and he woke up, and there was nobody there, and he has no doubt in his mind that it was her touching him.
Wow.
And he knew it was her touching him when he felt the hand on his shoulder. And so when you hear that, you're like, well, he was dreaming, or he could have been imagining that, or, you know, that he could have just been wanting that to happen, and so therefore he imagined it happened. But from his experience, it was not like any of those things. You know, it was definitely her there. And it's been a real kind of, as a person who studies science, it's been kind of a learning curve for me to be open to the possibility of those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people tell me about them, to try to put myself in their shoes and to be there with all of those experiences and understand and see the validity and the realness of them for people.
Right. Like, just as real as if your wife had put her hand on your shoulder, you would know, that's my wife. Yeah. She put her hand on my shoulder.
Yeah, he certainly knows the feeling of his wife's hand. And I actually think now, I actually believe that probably was what actually happened. I mean,
wow.
I actually think that. I don't know, of course, but...
I love that. So doing this kind of work has expanded your mind a little bit from not just cynical Buddhist mind, right?
Well, I still have that.
Well, I know.
I'm doing better.
Yeah, I mean, I have questioned a lot of the boundaries that I thought existed since my brother died. And, like, I had this little experience where he was a great photographer, and he's now at Shambhala Mountain Center. His ashes are at the Shambhala Mountain Retreat Center in the Rockies, and they're right behind this beautiful Torii Gate. I'm sure you know the one.
Mm-hmm.
And I inherited his camera, and I finally brought myself to look through it, going, please, God, may there be zero dirty pictures on this camera, which thankfully it was all beautiful scenery.
Oh, nice.
And there was a shot of this Torii Gate that he's buried just beyond, we're not buried, but his ashes are scattered. And it's the most beautiful shot that the sun comes in at this particular direction, and I swear it was one of the very last photographs he took.
Mm.
Was of this, what is now his final resting place.
Oh my gosh, wow.
And I took it to Kinko's to get it printed so that I could give it a couple of copies away. And the guy was so struck at Kinko's by this photo
he was like, that's really cool. And he ended up giving me, he said, you know what? I'm so taken with this picture. I'm just going to give you these on the house. My gift to you.
Hmm.
And I just really felt that it was some sort of wink from my, some sort of gift from my brother. And of course burst into tears. But I could just, and I felt his presence. And so I don't know how that's possible. But it has also been mind opening for me to have a many series of experiences like that, which sure you could say I'm just ascribing meaning where I want to find it. But, I don't know. There was really something about the energy of that moment that was something magical was happening.
Absolutely. That's a story you'll have for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Of course, my husband thinks that the guy just thought I was cute, but... So what have you learned from your time getting this really intimate snapshot of death and dying and grief over the last how many years?
16. Well, there's all kinds of things. They're all kind of learning curves that I'm on. One is, you know, how to help people who are grieving. So there's the whole idea of, you know, just studying the field of grief counseling. And when I was doing the hospice social work, you know, just studying the field of, you know, supporting the terminally ill and their loved ones. And both experientially sort of studying, you know, the people I'm working with to see what do I say and do that seems useful to them, and what do I say and do that's not useful for them, and sort of learning that way. And also, you know, learning from colleagues and learning from books. And so that's one sort of learning curve about trying to be skillful and effective in the work that I do. And another learning curve is I think we've already talked about this, sort of my own relationship with my own death and, you know, change in my own life and just...
How has it changed your relationship to knowing that death is coming?
For myself?
For yourself.
It's interesting to think about that question because, in a way, I don't know how it's changed it because I don't know what I would be like if I hadn't done this work for the last 16 years. I feel like I have a long way to go in terms of, you know, not being, you know, being, like I described, this sense of contentment with life and with death earlier. Well, I'm not completely there, and I feel like I still feel anxious. You know, I think about the death of my wife, and I think about the death of myself, and I think about how we'll handle those things, and I think about the death of close friends and my parents who are still living, and my siblings, and I'm perhaps more aware of that than other people. Just because it's such a big part of my work life, that I've seen so many different ways that people die, and I kind of think about who might die what way, and what way do I want to die, and what way do I not want
to
die. And
well, your mind has to go to some morbid places when you're a grief worker, right?
Yeah. So there is kind of a dark and scary side to just being around death a lot and just kind of. My mind can kind of maybe overly identify with clients and death. Mm-hmm. And so to compensate for that, I try to watch, we try to watch shows that are like funny, like when Nora wants to, you know, watch a show that's, you know, it's full of death and like violence and stuff, I'd be like, you go ahead and watch that.
Well, she works with children all day. She needs to watch that movie.
Yeah. She is the opposite. We have the opposite kind of thing. Like she's in a kind of fantasy play world all the time, and she wants reality.
Yeah.
And I'm in this intense reality, and I kind of want to play. So I'll go work in the garden. You watch that.
You
know, I'll go play Ultimate Frisbee with my friends. You watch the was that one? The Killing. That was one of them.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Anyway.
Yeah, well, a lot of us, I'd say most of us, maybe all of us, feels like we have to avoid death or not think about it, because that would just be depressing and morbid and, you know, just enjoy your life kind of attitude. But you don't really, you don't have the luxury of, so to speak, living in a fantasy world that that doesn't actually exist.
No, right. And I feel like, I feel like that's a blessing for sure. Even though there's this, this challenging side that I have to always work with and kind of, you know, stay identified with the, you know, with life. But there's so much blessing in it, in that I think I'm going to be more prepared for my own death than most people.
Yeah.
And for other people's deaths in my life. And accepting and ready and I don't know what I'm, what, you know, the next, my next major loss, whatever I have, you know, how I'll do with the grief process. That's interesting as a grief counselor. I haven't actually thought about that too much, but at least I'll know how to counsel myself.
Yeah, right? Or you won't. You'll won't. This is a lot harder than counseling someone else.
Right.
How do you counsel people? Do you, is it mostly just a process of listening and creating a safe space for them? Or is there a kind of teacher quality to it?
Oh, the, you know, just listening and creating a safe space is a big part of effective grief counseling, from my understanding. There's an educational component for sure for some people, to just help them understand what's normal for grieving, because there are a lot of things that are similar that people experience, like, you know, disturbance in their sleep or appetite and other things like that that they may not be aware of are just normal human grief that comes out of the human body. That's not, means they're, you know, doesn't mean they're crazy or that they necessarily need to, you know, seek treatments. And it just resolves on its own for most people.
Or that they're lazy, or that they're...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, working with the anger and guilt feelings that come up around the loss of a loved one for whatever kinds of reasons that they come up is very common. And so an educational component to help people understand that, you know, that they're doing okay, you know, that they're working through what they need to work through. So that there's a little bit of an educational component, yeah, in that way. And
do you lead groups, or it's mostly one-on-one?
Groups are very effective for a lot of people.
I'm in a grief group. That's the only sort of counseling I got. And it'll be a year in August since I've been in it. We all lost siblings. The people who stayed in the group, it was like 12 to begin with. Now it's 4. And the group is formally ended. Mm-hmm. But we keep meeting outside of it. And the people that are left, we all lost our older brothers. So we sort of wondered if maybe there's something about that particular thing that's like, really hard to get over psychologically or something.
Oh.
But yeah, just having the safe space to talk about it.
That's great. How did you find the group?
I had a friend who lost her brother, like in the Shambhala community, who lost her brother a few weeks before I did. And then she was like, you should really look into this group. Mm-hmm. So it's been helpful. Do you ever work, did you work with people at the end of their life before you specifically did grief counseling?
Uh, No, just my grandfather that I mentioned before. I I was his caregiver for a month after he broke his neck in a car accident.
Wow.
And he wasn't dying at that time. He recovered from the car accident. But he was in his, late 70s. And he didn't live too many years after that. So, but no, I didn't do any formal work in the field.
Yeah. So it's more steeped in the grief. What have you learned about grief in particular? It's such a weird thing. It's such an all-consuming and very malleable emotion, if you want to call it an emotion, experience.
Yeah. I've learned that people can go through amazing personal growth when they do grief work. In other words, engage with their grief in a conscious way, like you did with your group. I imagine you've experienced some significant insight and personal growth through doing that, or maybe just stabilization. Sometimes people find something out about themselves that they never knew through going through a grief process. So there's a whole sort of positive side that people who deny their grief or don't ever do grief work could, and just kind of like, this is this terrible thing that happened to me, and I'm never gonna, talk about it or try to understand what it means to me, or just work on it by themselves. It can turn into an illness, or it can be become an obstacle for them later in life, I think.
Right, and just sounds like you're also saying that they're kind of missing out.
Something else I've learned about grief, though, is that it's so can be so devastating and so just debilitating. And people can develop all kinds of, even people who are trying to do conscious grief work can have complicated reactions that are very hard to work with and to overcome.
Mm.
Some people don't ever really recover from grief.
Yeah, that's an important thing for people to know, actually. Because there's always this sort of, seems to me that people often think after a certain amount of time that time heals all wounds and that things, that it'll move on. But some people are really so changed to their core.
Yeah. I wasn't, insinuating that ideally people recover from grief.
Yeah.
Necessarily, but more like integrated into their life in a way that they can continue to function and enjoy and make new relationships. But people who get caught in what they call complicated grief can need a lot of extra help to move through it.
Mm.
Whether or not they ever get that help is up to them. So I've seen people in some pretty difficult places. And some people, I don't know if they've ever, I don't get to see everyone's whole story. So some people who I've interacted with, I never got to find out if they survived. They might have, killed themselves.
Right.
I don't know of anyone who's done that, but it happens. Most of the time we see, most of the people that come in for grief counseling have something that's extra difficult for them.
Because
most people don't need any grief counseling to get through a loss in a healthy way.
Really?
It's just inherent in human nature to understand and come to terms with a death in their life. It's part of life, and friends and family can support people to just keep living in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. People don't have, no, everyone doesn't have to do any kind of formal grief work. But people that do, the vast majority of them see, you know, the ability to re-engage in healthy ways and relationships and learn from the experience. And it's just a small percentage of people who kind of, the stuckness is just very difficult to move through.
Yeah.
And
I've seen people like that.
Yeah.
Is there a common theme among people that are really experiencing complicated grief? Is there any sort of overarching thread that you see that connects people that really struggle in that way?
One of them is isolation or lack of social connections.
Mm.
Whether it's real or perceived or, you know, self-created, but just it's a huge strength and for people who are grieving who come in and say, oh, but, you know, I have all these people around me who are caring and asking if they can help. And so that right there tells us that a person is likely going to be fine just in itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So social support is really one of the main themes of what dictates complicated versus healthy grief risk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then another one is mental health history and substance use history. And
I think I asked you if you had a TED Talk, what your TED Talk would be. I was wondering if you thought any more about that, or if there was something in particular that you just think, gosh, I really wish people understood this piece about grief or about death and dying in general.
I didn't prepare my TED Talk.
But Ted's outside.
I see there's someone in that car. That was a great question. You know, when you first asked that, I thought, you know, I love this idea and the sort of personal experience that of contentment that I have gained a little bit of through I think being in this field and having, you know, sort of the honor of working with people who are dying and people who are working with their grief is this, you know, to see contentment in them and to, it's kind of helped me to find contentment in myself with the changes in my life. So maybe it would be a TED Talk on contentment in the face of change.
That's a good title of a TED Talk. You already have a title. That's great. Contentment in the face of change. Yeah, it seems like that energy really can be conducive to creativity as well. Have you seen that with any of your grief sufferers that you are helping? Because for me, it's one of the blessing things that's come out of it has actually been creative energy, and a lot of it's like darker stuff. Like I told you, I wrote this How to Unfriend Your Dead Brother piece, but a lot of, you know, I think the whole this podcast and the whole other one that I host really kind of came out of that existential crisis where I had to kind of dig deep, where I was really forced by the universe to do some serious contemplation.
Mm.
And, you know, when you're cracked open,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of juice there.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking about, you know, people that I've worked with who might mirror your, you know, the newfound creativity you had after your brother's death. there was a man who lost his wife who struggled a lot. And he became a quilter. He already had a relationship with sewing and quilting, but he really leaned into it.
Mm.
And he was like the only man in his quilting group.
Oh, I bet.
He's part of this group that gives quilts away to needy people, hospitals, and things like that.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, I'm sure there's other examples I could think of, but
Of my friends in my grief group, her mother had a quilt made for her of all her brother's T-shirts. So all these little squares from his old T-shirts that otherwise they might have just tossed, right? So she has this super old T-shirt snuggly quilt that makes her feel close to her brother. Mm. I thought that was so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, we shouldn't have given all those away. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard of people making pillows and out of pieces of people's shirts after they've passed and things like that. That's cool.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll wrap up soon, but I wanted to ask you if there's what place humor has in grief.
When I was a social worker on the hospice team, it was important for us as a hospice team of colleagues supporting each other doing pretty difficult and stressful work to laugh together.
Yeah.
And sometimes we called it dark humor.
Mm-hmm.
Because we would have to make fun of the situations we were in, which we were all about death. So, there was that amongst colleagues, and there still is among my grief counseling colleagues. It's just, the self-care of supporting each other who do this work, and, chatting in the hallway and visiting each other in our offices and just providing a human heart, and we laugh together, and I'm growing some sea monkeys in a glass in the window of my office.
Oh, you are?
And I'm trying to get one of my colleagues to take them home to his children. And so we were laughing about these sea monkeys because he doesn't want them either. They're like little brine shrimp.
Oh, that's funny.
You hatch in a glass.
I'm yeah. Like, what came over you?
Oh, someone gave them to us.
Oh, funny.
And we were like, what are we going to do with this? We're Buddhists. These things are going to die.
Yeah.
Could we hatch these eggs or not hatch these eggs? I'm like, I can't give them to my friend if they're too old to hatch, so I have to hatch them myself in order to find out if they're going to survive.
So you're fostering the sea monkeys.
Yeah. And then with clients, I think it's very dicey to try to use humor with someone who's grieving or someone who's dying or someone who's in anticipatory grief, but it just naturally comes up, and that's just the
way
it
beautiful.
Is. But you can't. I don't sort of use it as a tool or a technique or something like that. I don't think that's
right.
That's some people may be able to because of their style and their personality, but there's a lot of respect of the pain and suffering that people are in.
Absolutely,
and that sort of has to come first, and humor can come out of that when there's just genuine interaction.
Right, it sounds like the natural, gentle kind of humor of mm-hmm. existence, but probably, if it were me, I'm sure I would accidentally slip in a one-liner insensitively at some point in 16 years. what is one thing that you wish... This has been fun because I've gotten to ask this to the few people that I've done this podcast with so far. Is there one thing that you wish for yourself? What is one thing you wish for yourself for your own death?
One thing I wish for myself, my own death?
A death wish, so to speak.
Yeah. It's to have a disease.
Hmm.
It's to die from a disease.
Wow.
Where I have time.
Yeah, time. Death and time.
I know I'm dying.
Oh, yes, yeah. I think that's very good wish.
Rather than an accident.
Yeah.
Or a sudden heart attack. I suppose you could call a heart attack a disease, but I mean, I'm talking about a
something where there's warning, yeah.
Cancer.
Yeah.
Cancer would work for me.
Wow. You're one of the only ones out there who wants cancer. Just no time soon, please. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Has the sudden death thing been one of the threads with complicated grief?
Has what?
Sudden death. Does that lend itself to complicated grief more? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, because you didn't get to say goodbye.
Yeah.
Get ready before the person died.
And then it gives you this feeling that something horrible could happen at any moment. I mean, I had a policeman come to the door a few weeks after my brother died, and that's how we found out. The policeman came to my mom's door. So a policeman came to the door, and my heart was racing. And then, of course, I open it, and they're like, does someone here own a gray Pontiac? And I'm like, oh, good, I just parked in front of someone's driveway, and they called the cops. Which is a true story, but just seeing a policeman at my door, I thought, well, who died, you know, or if my dad calls me and my mom and sister all text at the same time, I freak out,
mm-hmm.
which happens all the time because we have a big communicative family.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that's why there are support groups specifically for sudden losses.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Because it's a real kind of specific kind of loss that happens, you know, all the time. And it's got some specific components that other kinds of losses don't have. So just like you're describing.
Yeah. Wow, thank you for talking with me. I feel it has been like a free grief session too. It's nice to get to talk with you a little bit about this very strange, very powerful, real emotion experience of grief. And thank you for the work you do with people. I'm sure it's way more meaningful than you even realize. I'm sure you realize, but it's like being a life jacket for somebody.
Well, thank you for asking me so many deep and profound questions about my work. I don't get to talk like this with people very often, actually.
Mm.
You'd think I would.
But, yeah.
For people to ask me to reflect on the work that I do is a gift. So thank you.
Oh, good. Well, thank you very much for sharing. I think people are going to appreciate hearing this point of view of this incredible work you do. One last question, I swear. Is it depressing, your job?
Well, it's both. It's depressing and it's also inspiring.
Yeah.
You know, like I described, you know, some people that are really stuck and it's hard to get through and it's hard to help them or they don't really want to be helped or they don't, you know, allow us to help them. And, you know, we hear some scary stories and experience some people that are in high states of anxiety and deep depression themselves, and that can sometimes feel heavy and affects my own, and I definitely feel it in my own, you know, being, and
mm-hmm.
So that's why I have to do my own conscious self-care. But then there's the side of it that where you know, you see people have insight, and you see people talk about their you know, working through their anxieties and learning something about themselves and freeing themselves of some sort of self-doubt or, you know, habits that they've had all their life, and this death has brought about their ability mm-hmm. to see something about themselves they never saw before. And then there's there's a whole category of stories about people who are elderly, who've lived long lives, who are dying, and they're fine with it.
Mm.
And they talk about it with such confidence and fearlessness.
Wow.
And joy and laughter. And there's this whole, like, I have years of experience of being in the, we even use the phrase, like, being in the presence of people who are like so light, and like they're almost like they're getting ready to die, and they're letting go of everything in a way that's really sort of healthy and has this almost sort of spiritual feel to it, where they're just and being around them is just like a joy.
Yeah.
So there are all kinds of blessings in the work as well.
Wow, that's a beautiful image. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Yeah, it's like they're experiencing a little less gravity on the earth than the rest of us, or mm-hmm, something. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again.
Sure.
Lovely to chat with you. Good luck with the sea monkeys.
This conversation is brought to you by the When You Die Project. From existential afterlife questions to palliative care and the nuts and bolts of green burial, if it has to do with death, we're talking about it. WhenYouDie.org.